This is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Art Center. And I am here on February 12th, 2015 with Jody Hansen. And we're going to be talking about her work today. So, Jody, if we could get right into it. These questions are very general in some ways, but these are the questions I ask all artists. And sometimes I feel like there's a difference between what inspired you to want to pursue a career in the arts versus, you know, why do you make things? You know, and I feel like there's because we're all creative in different ways and that sort of thing, and sometimes we don't know why we are creative. You know, like it's like, why do we breathe in many ways?
Why the drive?
Right. But as best as you can, what inspired you to want to be an artist?
Well, I, as a child, I took art classes, and I was always making things. And my parents really encouraged that and supported that through various classes. When I was younger, we would go to college, and there would be like Saturday morning art classes. So I was always doing things in a creative way. And through high school, I took. I was fortunate enough that my high school actually had silversmithing, with torches and doing casting and things like that. So I got into doing metal work at a fairly young age. And in high school, I took metalsmithing and stained glass. So I continued that metalsmithing into college and got my bachelor's of fine arts, pretty directed in the one field of silversmithing. I took the mandatory other classes, drawing and painting and sculpture and ceramics, but I really only took what I had to in those areas, and I stuck to silversmithing as my primary, which in retrospect I regret a little bit. Like, I never took a printmaking class or some of the other areas that I could have investigated. And then sticking with that really straight arrow approach, I went straight on to graduate school and got my master's in silversmithing at the University of Illinois. I moved to New York. And then had that freak out moment, like, how could my parents let me get an art degree? You know, like, what were they thinking? All of a sudden, and prior to that, it had been very liberating, and then all of a sudden, boom.
This is all their fault.
Reality sets in. But I have worked in the arts all my life, because when I was in graduate school, I started working at the museum there, and that has been my career path. So I have always been in an art field, in an art context, you know, in my personal pursuits and my professional pursuits as well.
How did you come to, were you able to merge the silversmithing with the museum work, or?
Yes, and that has been nice, because as my work has changed over the years, I started doing installation and work on paper, and I really abandoned the silversmithing, which I miss because I really like the process, but I just found that what I wanted to make at the time didn't fit with that kind of work. When I was in school, I was making art jewelry, you know, jewelry that really pushed the boundaries of wearable jewelry. And so when I graduated, the two typical career paths at that time would be you either teach or you work making jewelry for somebody else at their bench. And I knew that I didn't want to do either of those. So I just kept working at museums, and it just turned into a career. And so what I do now that merges the metal smithing is I make armatures for sculptures and artifacts and plates, things that need support in a certain way to be presented. So the great thing is I'm still able to use the metal smithing because sometimes you kind of yearn to have done something that you did a long time ago, that all that knowledge that you had, I can still apply it to what I do today. So that's really great for me. And silversmithing is a specialized skill, and there's not that many people who have the museum background and the metals background to actually pull that together. So those projects are pretty fun, and not everybody can do them. It's special.
That's fantastic. And quite honestly, this right here is a great example to me of why we do these interviews, because I did some research into you prior to this, but mostly just reading reviews and things like that. And I'm like, okay, she's inspired by, you know, science and also pushing the boundaries of different types of installation and playing with that line. But I didn't know too much about your background with silversmithing, you know? And that's really fantastic. I'd like to talk at some point and soon about kind of how the transition within your personal art went. But what I do love about museums, you know, working in museums myself, and what I kind of learned a long time ago, and I was trying to figure this out for myself too, I have a background in art history, you know, which is similar and even maybe even more esoteric and removed from actual skills in some ways. But museums have this ability to draw people with such diverse skill sets. You know, that's why sometimes I'm critical of museum studies programs, because it's almost so, it's looking it so in the face that I feel like you're missing a lot of the surrounding experiences outside of museums that end up influencing what you do in museums. You know what I mean? But that's sort of my personal thoughts about it. As an artist, how did your choice of where you went to school influence your abilities? Can you talk a little bit about your education background? I will say, having the experiences you had before college with, you know, art creation in a controlled setting to do such, like, very advanced work.
And sadly, I don't know if schools are able to offer that now. See, I mean, even I've heard some schools don't even offer ceramics because clay is too expensive. And when I wasn't doing silversmithing in high school, I mean, we did pay for our own materials. But, you know, as you see schools having to reduce and cut and go to more of an austerity kind of curriculum, you don't know if kids have those opportunities like I had. For undergrad, I went to Indiana University, where my parents both worked. So for me at that time, while I didn't necessarily want to stay in my hometown, it was cheap. And it was a good program for being in-state. And so, I mean, of all of the schools I could have been at in-state, it was probably the best program. So I chose that for, you know, very smart reasons to stay there. And then for grad school, I looked at many schools. I considered New Paltz. And really what I ended up going again with a good financially sound choice, and also one that had a really, a very large program in that there was a lot of space for the facility and there were really good facilities. So both of those were good financial choices. When I left school, I had no debt, and which really helped later down the road. And I also got to teach. And so I felt like, you know, those were two really good choices for me. And then moving to New York, and also in grad school, getting that museum background of working in a museum for about 2 years before I moved to New York. So when I was moving to New York, my mentor at the museum, I got this book out, and things used to be in books, not on the internet. And I got about 40 different places that I sent my resume to in New York. And I said to her, I need to get an internship. And she said, no, you need to get a job because you have the knowledge at this point. And so I worked at the Guggenheim. That was my first job in New York. I worked on the installation crew, which is a pretty good place to start. And I was there as a freelancer and then on staff for about 3 years. I worked at the final project that I worked on there was opening the museum in Bilbao, Spain, where I lived for about 4 months working on that grand opening. It was a wonderful project.
So what was that like? I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about
it? Sure. Well, it felt like we moved a mountain, really, to Spain. It was, the very first shipment was about 14 semis worth of artwork, and it went on one of the largest planes in the world. It's called the Antonov. It's a Russian cargo plane. And so first in New York, we prepared all the works to go, which meant everything from detailed photography to reframing to recreating to conservation. I mean, everything had to be done before it went. So there were a lot of things to coordinate with different departments. And it was a small crew that actually worked on that. And the first shipment went over. I sent 15 semis to Newark Airport. It took 3 days to load the airplane, and then one semi was sent back because those works didn't fit. And these were works that were so large they couldn't fit on any other aircraft. That's why this specifically had hired this Russian cargo plane. And then after that, I prepared another 6 shipments, and I went on one of those shipments. Mine was a double tractor trailer that landed in Germany and then trucked through to Spain. And after I arrived, we probably received about 6 more shipments. So it was pretty crazy.
Can I just say, it felt so, I didn't work at the museum during the transition from across the street from here, but I was very close friends with people and I volunteered, and that felt crazy enough. I can't even fathom.
Yeah.
That's...
And moving into a new facility, which I'm sure you experienced here, I mean, there's all sorts of things that maybe aren't finished yet, or systems aren't really in place yet, and just sort of getting all that up to speed, plus the crushing workload of getting everything up, you know. So it was crazy. We worked every day. Over the 4 months, I had 2 half days off, I think, and it was a really wonderful experience.
That's something that you can't.
You can't.
I mean, there's just nothing you can.
Yeah.
You're either there or you're not. 99% of people were not in situations like that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. And so do experiences like that, I can both read that as a show of character and a show of like what you're willing to take on and like be like, all right, we're going to open up a new museum in Spain. This is happening.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
Because actually within the Guggenheim, there was sort of 2 camps.
Yeah.
There were the people who just somehow resented that this other museum was opening. I don't know if it was because they felt like we didn't have the internal resources to do this, which was really a struggle, or I don't know what the thinking was, but you really it was very politically touchy, and you really had to work through that. And I did find that, you know, I have always been a person who has approached, okay, this needs to get done. How can we make this happen? Versus trying to put up roadblocks. There are people who do that, and they have reasons. Maybe they're trying to set a precedent, but I don't come from that. I come from you give as much as you can give. Like if you're working with an artist and they need some things, and you be really real with them about what you can do, and you're not falsely telling them that something can't happen when you know it can. So that kind of approach.
Do you find that mentality comes out in your work and how you work with your materials? This isn't a question on this. This is...
Well, I would say that in terms of the salt and the oil, I mean, they're not like, you know, big. They're not mysterious and they're not hard to work with. But I think in terms of pushing what they can do or just not being limited by what might happen, that comes through a little bit. I mean, I will say that when I moved to New York, I was still had a functioning metals bench, and I made metals. I did jewelry in my apartment. And then it was through that experience at working at the Guggenheim and other big institutions that I realized, oh, I could do a whole installation. You know, I could do a room. I could do a 12-foot by 16-foot screen and do a projection. And that, you know, I didn't know that that was out there. So I think those experiences have sort of allowed me to think anything is possible, you know?
Absolutely. When you've opened up a museum in Spain, really everything else feels a little more doable.
Oh, and there's the language barrier
yeah.
and all sorts of things like that. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. I'd also say, too, what I really enjoy about your work is the way in which it alters the way we look at very known materials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes salt and oil and, you know, both looks at their chemical properties and the ways they interact while also creating like a aesthetic and very contemplative and almost meditative object.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I find now talking with you now, I find the sort of limitlessness in the way you're like, well, we can perceive these things beyond what we know
mm-hmm.
of how we're supposed to interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's where art goes or whether it's, you know, everyday materials. I don't know, just thoughts. I do that sometimes. I'll take sort of things that we talk about and then I'll wax poetic, and half
mm-hmm.
the time it's not poetic.
Another experience that I had in New York was I worked for an artist for many years,
mm-hmm.
and she was a conceptual artist, which meant every project that we did was new territory. It wasn't like you work for a painter and you went in and you know, I'm going to stretch some canvases, I'm going to mix up some paint, I'm going to do these things. Every project was learning a new language, maybe, for that medium or that area, learning new terms, learning new ways to do things. And so that also helped me to stretch and think about, you know, how I would approach a project. So when I wanted to stay with salt but expand that color palette to do the mandala project that I did for the Castellani, I knew how to research how to find other materials that I might want to use. And that kind of came through working for her. Mm-hmm. And so that was another experience that feeds into my art now.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. It's kind of maybe going in a similar vein. Maybe we've touched about it, but who have been some of your most important influences, both through mentors and, you know, maybe people you've worked with? We've already talked about some situations you've been in, but perhaps influential artists that you encountered.
You know, like big icons with the big eye for me are Terrell and Irwin. You know, their use of light. They're just really masters of simplicity. And I respond to their works, as well as Olafur Eliasson is another artist who, like, I'll be working on something and then I'll realize he already did it. You know, those moments where you're like, oh, darn, you know.
How does that make you feel when those moments happen?
Well, it's frustrating because in some cases, they're not even works that are in art history that you probably should have already known about. It's that you literally walk into a gallery and you're like, oh, that's what I was thinking of, or that's what I already started working on, and then this person has already done it. I don't know. It's frustrating, but it also lets you know that you're on a kind of a good path, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's okay. Yeah.
I find I have a lot of friends who are artists, and some of them are like, you know, I just need to put the blinders on. I don't care if other people are doing similar things to me. You know, I just need to put the blinders on and figure out what my idea is, because if I start knowing what other people are going to be doing, that will influence what I create. And then there are other people who are like, oh, that happened, I'm not going to make that thing in a similar vein that I was thinking of. And then, but that also makes me think, you know, other than the original act of creation, you know, one of the postmodern tenets is just that originality is not this huge concept that, and especially with the internet and the way we all connect, originality is kind of both overdone in some ways and in other ways still so vital, because it's still like this one individualistic creation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, like they say, everything's already been done. So it just depends, I guess, on, you know, where you're, maybe what you're trying to achieve with the piece, too. Mm-hmm. You know, like with the mandalas, for example, you know, I had a real sort of psychological goal with those works that I don't think I would be upset if I saw something similar, because it came from such a deep place in my work that I really needed to get it out and do them. And so I don't think that in that particular situation, because it was so personal, that I would be upset about seeing something similar. Now, if I were trying to make a big splash in an artwork, and then I think it would be like if I were trying to make a seminal work and then I realized somebody else had done it, I think that would be kind of different.
Yes.
Because one is sort of from the inside and one is sort of trying to be showy,
kind of
difference.
Yep.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Which leads us into my next question is, can you talk about, we've talked about metalsmithing and we've talked about the mandalas and we've touched a little bit about how intrigued you were by installation and that sort of thing. But can you talk about your art and what you create and why you create it?
So I have a couple of different types of ways that I have worked, say, in the last 8 years. I was in Beyond In,
I believe 2010.
Okay, that sounds about right. And I did an installation piece there that was a nighttime piece. It was a projection of light through liquid. So everything's in real time. While it looks like video or film, there is nothing pre-recorded about that work. So every moment is unique, and that is really a key theme for me, that it's live and unique. And so I was doing those projection works, and I was in a show in Brooklyn, and the gallery was going to have two projection works, but they wanted something that they could sell. And somehow they didn't consider those sellable works, even though I knew that they were, because you have to broaden your idea of what you can sell and what people are willing to buy. But I started working with the same oil on paper and allowing the oil to be on the paper and move through the paper in its own time and its own way, so that I controlled certain aspects of it, but I didn't ultimately control it. And that carried through with the salt and the other chemistry pieces. So for me, live is a really important part of my work. And a trueness to materials is also a very important theme in my work. And in terms of my creative process, going back to school, I had sketchbooks, I did visual research. Most of those sort of led to the production of a particular work or a body of work. But I think that now I'm around art a lot, and I am looking at things more through a worldview than necessarily a sketchbook or a visual research like that. Everything is sort of framed, everything I see and experience in the world is through this framework of being an artist. So that feeds into my creative process, and that could be anywhere, really. That could be something that interests me that, just throughout normal day, or through like a nature walk, or going to a museum, but it just comes from a lot of different places.
If the live aspect, how do you think about the fact that, well, the live aspect is very important to you now, but what you do with metalsmithing historically is something where you see the product, but maybe not the process. You know, like the live component is hidden. Do you see them as just two totally separate things?
Yeah, they're really different. They're really different. The thing about when making metal work, in some cases, is it was almost like you were making something in metal that looked like something sometimes. Not to say that every piece of jewelry or silversmithing is that way, but sometimes that's the case. Like, okay, so you want a leaf in your piece, so you tool it out of leaf, or you out of silver, or you cast it in something, but it's not a leaf. It's a representation of a leaf. And that was sort of where the break kind of happened for me. So when I had a studio in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, and when my first transition out of metals was working with plexiglass. And I don't know why exactly, except that I was trying to work with liquids and I wanted to make a housing that would allow you to still see the liquid. And I could form. So I started working in plexi, and there was this moment when I made this piece that had liquid in it, trapped in it, and I wanted to be inside the piece. And that was when I started doing the projections, because I kind of thought, how could I make this huge piece of plexi and I could still, and I thought, no, that's never going to work. So how can I make the illusion that you're inside this piece? And that really led me to start doing the projection work. And I did a show where there were some pieces too that were based on light and light on the viewer and some different sort of research into light therapy and effects of light. And that ties in with Terrell and Irwin and people that use that as their medium, which is still something that I want to get back to for some future pieces.
Are you still making installations now?
Not now. Right now, I'm working on 2D work. Not to say that I wouldn't consider it. Yeah, I mean, certainly I would consider doing an installation-based piece in the right setting. Or I recently had a visit about a public art piece, which isn't an installation. I mean, it is, but it isn't, And that's a more permanent thing. So gets you thinking about that. Yeah. And even if that, say, shouldn't come through, it might lead to an installation that I could, propose for another location. So, yeah.
And was that in Buffalo? That is one of the things I love about Buffalo. I mean, it's such compared to New York. It's like, well, there you can't, but it's so much easier to have these relationships and these connections that you don't necessarily know where they're going to end up. But it's like, okay, well, even if this doesn't go where we think it's going to go, I know that it's going to continue to influence my world here, you know. That's kind of what happened with
Birchfield. And those are sort of the kernels that kind of lead you down. And that's the thing about you're looking at things through this framework of an artist, mm-hmm. you know, kind of, oh, that's interesting. So maybe that'll end up being in a piece mm-hmm. later down the road. Yeah.
I feel like we kind of touched on this next one, which is talking about the totality of your body of work and different themes that have emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you'd like to say about maybe the installations and maybe the mandalas or
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or other themes that we haven't touched on?
Well, I think that just currently, you know, my work is really about slowing down and commanding the attention that comes from a live work in terms of the projections. Again, every moment is unique, so if you aren't there, you don't see it. Something really special happens. It's really just for you or whoever's there with you. It's not going to be like you can come back later and see it again. So the works, for me, they command that kind of time and space.
And I feel like this is a very good interview. I feel like I like interviews where I go on to the next question and realize, actually, we've kind of talked about this. But is there anything else you'd like to say about your creative process? I mean, you work in very mm-hmm. different media, you know, mm-hmm. between metalsmithing and installations and mm-hmm. the mandalas. Mm-hmm. But what parts about you are there through all of them?
Well, the mandalas were very personal because the title of that show was Imperfect. And for me, it was about working through, I called myself a reformed perfectionist. And kind of working through coming to grips with life and how things don't always work out the way you expected them to. And not like giving up your expectations, certainly, but sort of tempering things. And so that creative process was very personal and cathartic for me. And then what I hope is that people who see the works get something out of it for them. The piece that I had here that was part of the Barge project that was downstairs called Eddie, I was evidently someone from a class who was studying textile design used that as an example of a work she wanted to talk about, in that sometimes you start a project in a certain way and you don't know where it's going to lead, or you have to be open to changes that come through the design process. Mm-hmm. So that piece isn't really about design, but it is about kind of tempering, you know, your expectations. And all sorts of things happened on that piece that I would have thought went wrong, but I let them happen and I embraced them and I didn't reject it as unsuccessful. And so now, and then when you come around to that, you know, it's a good piece. So, and somebody else got something from it. And I think that for me, I mean, I think that a lot of people make art just for themselves, but you know, I mean, I want somebody to get someone else to get something out of it. It doesn't have to be the same as what I had intended.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask what led you to first start exploring salt and oils in these ways?
Mm-hmm. Well, the oil came from doing that show where I was using the oil for something else, and I thought, why don't I try this? The salt was, I had done the oil pieces, and I kind of wanted to move on to something else, but I wasn't quite sure what that should be. And I was doing a project in Salem, Mass. I was opening not a new museum, but I was opening a very large expansion. And so I lived in Salem, Mass. For about 6 months. And that was in about 2003. And I was in that area, and I was thinking a lot about import-export. I was thinking about the spices that came, the salts that came. You're not on the open water there, but there's a historic boat there, and you're definitely in a sea town when you're in Salem, Mass. I mean, Salem, Mass. At one point was possibly going to be the large port in Massachusetts versus Boston. So you're in it. You're in this history. And I had an extra room. I had a lot of free time at night. And I just decided to get some salt. I was reading a book about salt at the time. And I picked up some salt samples. And I just mixed them with water and started putting them on paper to see what would happen. And so that's sort of the the great thing about having time as an artist to just experiment with something. And that's how I got started using that material. So for me, it was a pure material. It was recrystallizing in its own time, which had a live quality to it. And it also had things that I couldn't predict and I couldn't control. I mean, I have one particular work that I made then I've never been able to duplicate. I've tried because I like it. I want to keep going with that. I can't do it again. So it's very unique. So that's how I got started on that. And then my recent work with the mandalas is that I started doing cyanotypes. So that has certain qualities, unpredictable, not so much live, but I wanted to stick with the mandala and I wanted to be in nature. And so those were sort of two criteria. I started last summer and it's something I want to continue this summer. And if I don't know if you're familiar with that process, but essentially the cyanotype is what blueprints were. This is how they were produced. And so it's a specialty coated paper that you can either purchase or make yourself. And you keep it out of UV light, and then once you expose it to the UV light, the image is captured in the paper, and then you wash it, and then it's fixed. And so I started collecting plant samples and pressing them, drying them, pressing them, and organizing them, and I started doing the mandalas with those plant samples. And that's a process of just collecting them, which was something I wanted to do. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be in my garden. I wanted to be on a nature walk. I wanted to be thinking along those terms so that I could kind of continue with this process.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Charlie Birchfield would have resonated with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. We went on a trip last year to Salem, Ohio, which is where Birchfield grew up.
Uh-huh.
And Tullis and Scott and I went on what's great about the archival resources we're able to take young Birchfield's maps of the town he grew up in and where he would go paint and overlay it on Google Maps and go out there and go wandering in the same woods he did and seeing, and so we went on, you know, into the same groves that he would have gone into, and we saw the spring wildflowers that so captivated him to the point where he kind of had taken over his mother's little, she had a little grape arbor, and he kind of took it over and planted all these wildflowers underneath it so he would even have closer access to them for paintings. And what was most incredible about that for me is that, you know, in his paintings, these flowers that have this, like, larger-than-life quality, in reality, were so small and fragile. You know, early spring flowers really reserving a lot of their energies and that sort of thing. And, yeah, that naturalistic aspect of it, both of what you do and just, I don't know, what the mission of this place partially is, feels really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If that was ever a process that you wanted to, like, talk about or maybe do a demonstration of or anything like that, that might feel like it would have a lot of resonance here.
Those are easy to do in a group setting.
Especially with Tony's background at the Eastman House and stuff like that, and cyanotypes and early forms of, you know, photographic mediums and that sort of thing. That sounds, that could be really cool.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I know this has been a strange morning, but I'm so happy that this is happening. I'm really, really enjoying this interview.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So this next question, I don't know, sometimes I roll my eyes at it myself but I also like the different perspectives people give me back on it. You know, what do you hope to achieve with your art? It can be very, very over the top, but also very honest for some people. So.
Well, I sort of talked about this a little bit with the slowing down, the commanding your attention, like with the example of the student who picked my piece downstairs to be her talking point, you know, just something that other people get something from the work that maybe, while it may be very personal to me, it still resonates with them.
Wonderful. Yeah. And especially I think the mandalas is just, you know, when you look at it from a distance, sometimes you don't even see the detail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these types of mediums that encourages you to get close.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you're close, you realize there's this whole other world that you weren't even aware was there from across the room.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to that end, you know, my piece that's here, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, that's called White, which is in your collection. For that was a very risky piece for me. I wasn't sure if it was enough. And I was considering like Agnes Martin and other people who work with a really faint line and a really, it's minimalist, but it's also like sensitive art. And just thinking, you know, or Ryman, you know, white, you know, but there's a difference. And just sort of like, is that enough? It's not a big splash, but it's, that's just not the way, that's not the work I want to make at this time. So looking at some other artists as an example, mm-hmm. that it's okay.
Mm-hmm. You can be quiet.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have this really unique perspective. Not only are you an artist, you also work in the arts. And so you get to see the institutional side of it too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that's something that also for me, you know, I've started seeing more and more clearly the past few years. Given your unique experience base, what are some of the things that you've done to advance your career in the arts? And also, what are some of the opportunities you might have had that had unexpected implications for your career?
So, well, sort of in terms of advancement, I'm a poor excuse of career advancement because I feel, because I have so many times put my profession above my career as an artist, giving, you know, like 120% to the museum or to the artist that I work for at that time. And so there have been times where my work has been on the back burner. I guess that where maybe that starts to even out is the experiences I had in working at those institutions and with other artists and in all different ways. You know, I've worked with antiquities to contemporary art. Mm-hmm. It's been a really big range. Mm-hmm. Projects or advancement opportunities. I mean, certainly being in Buffalo there's a lot of opportunities for artists here. You know, when Beyond In was active and opportunities through Hall Walls and the Topspin show and, you know, maybe the Barge project, depending on how that comes together for local artists. I mean, there's a lot here. And so I have been fortunate that I have made the time to be involved in those opportunities.
Awesome. And what brought you to Buffalo?
I took a position at the Albright Knox. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was in New York for 13 years and I worked at probably just about every cultural that you can work at, because in New York most people work freelance, and so that allows you to kind of be a lot of different places sort of in the high season of install. And then I came here for the position in charge of exhibition and had that department for about 5.5 years. And also, we as a family, New York is a very hard place to live for a long time, and it's also a place for people with money. And we weren't really in that situation. And so it's just been good for us to have more time and space to work and a little easier going lifestyle. And I have a son who's 10. And New York is great for kids, but it's also can be hard in other ways. And so, you know, this was a good balance for us. And I do go back to work quite a bit. And we go back to go to museums and things like that. So it's within striking distance. I wish it was a little bit closer, maybe half as close as it is. But it's still where we go. We don't go to Toronto or anything for art. We always go to New York. Mm-hmm. So,
do you feel that, and maybe it's almost a little cliche, but in some ways do you feel this more contemplative work has had more room to grow outside of New York?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because... Well, one of the problems with living in New York is that you always feel like you should be going out there and doing something. So after leaving New York, I had some regrets that I didn't go to the Met once a month or something like that, you know, or go to Chelsea more frequently. And so the problem is there's too much to do. And so you find that you just feel like you should be out there doing it all the time, or you could be going to openings all the time. And in a way, I even kind of felt that in grad school. Like, I was in Illinois in the middle. I was actually in the town I was born. And you're really kind of in the middle of nowhere. There's not a lot to do. But I felt like that was actually good for grad school, because I can't even imagine kids that go to college in New York City. I mean, the buzz, which is exciting, but just the you can do anything at any time, anywhere is too much, you know? So here, definitely, I feel like there, you could do more quiet work and have more time to think through it, definitely.
Thank you. So one of the reasons that the Living Legacy Project was started was it kind of grew out of the awareness that, okay, we cannot give every artist an exhibition at the museum, you know, that's not the model. But at the same time, what can we be doing as an institution that celebrates Western New York artists to further or to promote or to support artist careers in Western New York in other ways? Really try to provide a stable and much more comprehensive view at your career as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So all this is my way of saying that this project grew out of an awareness that we want to, the Birchfield wants to find more ways to keep the lines of communication open with artists to help them express what their needs are more clearly and for the Birchfield to have more avenues to hear that and respond to that. So perhaps given your unique perspective of being in New York for so long and now being here, but being a, you know, very big part of the Buffalo community here, can you identify any needs you might have of as an artist that the Western New York community could provide you with or that you would like to see more developed here in Western New York?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly funding is like the key thing. I mean, you know, the fact that artists typically, you have a show, okay, so you're going to get a show, so you have to pay for your own frames or your own framing, maybe you have to pay for your card and certain things like that, that, you know, you're already providing the work, you know, and then to have the additional resources to do that is a challenge. And sometimes it's prohibitive. You know, I had this recent meeting about a public artwork, and I wasn't sure whether, you know, I was going to have to fund it myself. And it's not beyond the realm of conceivability that you would have to fund it yourself. And I knew that that wouldn't be something I could do. And actually, that particular project wouldn't be the way it's set up. But you just don't know. And I think that, you know, artists funding their own work is a really big challenge for artists. So that is one area, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I think this project is great. Mm-hmm. Actually, a gallery in Brooklyn contacted me recently because they had found my name on your website, because they were doing a publication and, you know, people had, you know, the gallery had been in business for, I don't know, 20, 30 years. And so people are scattered all over the place. And so somehow they found me through, through your website. So that's nice. That's nice that that's available for people and that it was searchable in a way that somehow they Googled or whatever, you know?
One of the best things, quite honestly, about our website is that our Google algorithms are really tight.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody even just Googles Jodi Hanson artist and we are the first thing that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are all sorts of other flaws about the website, but that is the one thing that is just incredibly important.
Yeah.
And so, and, you know, what we're offering to artists in the Living Legacy Project is both the interview here, but also opportunities for continuing resources that we're still developing.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we had a dinner at Scott Popiak's house for all the artists of the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, in some ways, it's both about, like, yeah, maybe the Birchfield pulling this together in some ways, but also us stepping back and letting, you know, all the artists just have a space to communicate in a room together that maybe they don't normally have that opportunity, you know, and seeing, you know, Sylvia Rosen talking with Bethany Krall and really seeing this cross-generational building of relationships, though granted, Sylvia Rosen and Bethany Krall did already know each other, for the record, but providing that, and then also hopefully doing more workshops in the future about, from what I can offer, about preservation, you know, about documentation strategies of how to, you know, what sort of things should you be documenting for everything that you're producing, especially for younger artists, you know. Do you write the year on the back of your sketches and that sort of thing, or even on the front, you know, like what are you including or what aren't you including that later on might come and bite you? Things like that, because we really are reaching out to artists at every stage of their careers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, all that is a really long answer to trying to say that what happened with that gallery is exactly what we want to happen. And with artists like you, we also want to have your CV there, you know, with no personal information, but we want to have as many resources about you as possible so that nobody has to go to a second website trying to get more information. You know, we want articles linked. We want to really, and also what I found with some younger artists as well, they have a website for a while, and then maybe money gets tight or something, and then they can't pay for the website, or they can't update it or design it or something like that, and it falls by the wayside, and it makes them angry, but they kind of, once you start letting that slip, sometimes you have to put in way more effort to get it back up.
Yeah.
So if we can provide a stable outlet that transcends that, and also for the older artists as well who never got a website.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
that's really what we're trying to offer in some ways. So.
Well, and at some point, you may interview someone again, I imagine.
That's my...
And so it would be interesting to, you know, like if you'd taken a snapshot of me 5 years ago and then now, I mean, you know, a lot has happened in 5 years. I mean, just to kind of have people at those different times, and you can't know that until you start to build your database.
Exactly.
So,
and that's
yeah,
that's actually really exciting to me, because some young artists like Esther Neeson, I don't know if you know her, but she's a local artist who also works with light. She's she has been making these assemblages of that look like insects, but they're made out, and they are, but they're made out of old
slides,
film,
yes,
slides
mm-hmm.
of film.
I've
and
seen
that
those.
Sort of thing.
Yeah,
And so we interviewed her a few years ago. You know, she's been doing this for a while now, but she's still very young. You know, and I'm really excited to see what's going to happen with her 5 to 10 years from now. So I think you touched on this as well, but looking forward with your life in Buffalo and your life beyond Buffalo, and you know, you going out and all over the place and coming back from where you're at now, what would help advance your artistic career? You know, funding, let's say funding aside, because I think we kind of touched on that.
Right, right. And, well, opportunities. I mean, you know, to have a show, like you said, are you going to do another installation? And it's like, oftentimes I do an installation based on the site. So unless I'm offered a site, I'm not necessarily going to be thinking about an installation. Like, I may drive around Buffalo and think, oh, that would be such a great building to do something in. But more often, I'm probably gonna than not, I'm gonna need to site available, and then I start thinking about it. So, you know, that an opportunity to show, you know, an invitation to show. I mean, I make work all the time, but then I also make it with a project in mind. So it kind of goes both ways. Certainly, more things come from a project that's already out there. You know, so that would be one thing. I like working with groups of people, so, you know, an opportunity to maybe do like a workshop with something is nice too.
Good. Well, that's good, because that's things that I'm starting to think about. Wonderful. When we do these interviews, and when I was first structuring these questions, I was imagining who's listening to this. You know, like what questions are we asking and why are we asking them? And in addition to promoting artist careers, I'm also imagining the people listening to them, and I'm imagining people who maybe are young, maybe who are either considering going to school for fine art, or maybe just getting out of school for fine art, and at that sort of juncture that I've kind of gotten a sense of, that moment of, oh my God, what did I do? I got a fine arts degree. And that moment of trying to reconcile one's ideals with the challenges of practical reality. So I often have this question, my last question, which is, what advice do you have for emerging artists? That being said, a lot of people have a hard time with that question. Because they're like, well, what I would tell them depends on who they are. I would talk to them for a while. I would get a sense of their unique experience. So maybe what I'm actually going to change the question to on my piece of paper eventually is an alternative, which would be, what advice would you give yourself at the beginning of your career?
Well, it's the same in the answer that I was thinking about, which is really to take time between undergrad and grad school. So I took this very streamlined approach. You know, I did the medals in high school, And I do think that people get, if you're going to go to grad school, which isn't for everybody, and I wouldn't say that, I haven't surveyed every program in the U.S., but I feel like a lot of programs are probably not that great. So I don't know if it's worth it to go to grad school, but if you were going to go to grad school, I think you should take time between undergrad and grad. I think that life experience is really important, and I think that you're going to get more out of grad school if you wait. and you just experience life for a while. And I think that life experiences on the whole, I feel like they feed into my work, and I've now where I wasn't as open to that before. And I think sometimes you just think, oh, I'm gonna go have this experience, you know, whether it's a trip or a residency or a going to see a show or something. I'm just gonna say this is an experience that I want to have, and you know, just let that be what it is. It doesn't have to lead to anything. It can lead to something. You don't have to continue it. You just have the expectation that it's going to be an experience. And so I think that those things feed into your work and your approach, whether you mean for them to or not. They kind of filter in over time. Mm-hmm. So that would be my suggestion.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, I want to thank my family. I forgot to thank my family at a really important talk one time, and it was not good.
Oh. You get a little leeway in those situations.
I think you do. I think you do when you have like 40
the
people
lights.
Staring at you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my husband's an artist too, so, you know, we often feed off each other in terms of either working in sometimes tangential ways, mm-hmm. or, you know, just helping each other,
mm-hmm.
and so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you have now thanked them for all of eternity.
Right.
Well, Jody, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For coming into the Birchfield today.
Thank you.
And participating in the
mm-hmm.
Living Legacy.